This is David Duke. This is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent wherever they may live upon the earth. And certainly this program is very valuable, I think, and important for all people. I always say it, and it needs to be repeated again and again, because the media continually tries to portray me as a supremacist, or as a hater, as a racist. I don't buy into those definitions. I am certainly proud of my heritage. I want to preserve my heritage, my way of life, my traditions and values in America. And I think that's true for all people, all peoples on the planet. And you know what? I think all people have that right. I am opposed to colonialism. I'm opposed to any sort of oppression. I don't think America should have 68 bases all over the world. I don't think that we should try to determine what kind of governments they have, what kind of culture they have, and I don't think it's good for us to export our culture to other lands. And I tell you something, the culture of what is becoming the United States of America is very, very different from what our forefathers believed in. It's far more a culture of the Jewish supremacists who have a supremacy in the United States over our cultural, our media, and in many ways our political networks in the United States. The Washington Post just recently ran a story, and they admitted that 50% of the Democratic candidates for president, 50% of the money of the Democratic candidates, of all the candidates for president, comes from Jewish sources. That's 2.3% of the population providing 50% of the money. You think that's not going to influence elections and influence what candidates do? They have the most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C., AIPAC, and that's the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and a tremendous network of people. If they determine that someone they feel is a threat to Jewish interests or Israeli interests, whether it be in foreign policy or domestic policy, they can not only keep that individual from receiving a lot of financial support. And by the way, financial support, I know this. I've been in politics. I've been elected to office twice. I've been in many elections. The money is a key in elections, and that's one shame about America. It's not about who has the best ideas anymore. It's about who has the most money and who has the most support from the from what you call the network of powerful and influential people. There's a wholesale vote getting and what they call a retail vote getting. And we need an elections where we take special interest money out of it. And the Jewish supremacists, such as Stephen Steinlight, who I always talk about, he's such an interesting individual. He's said so many revealing things. This is the former head of the domestic policy, the national affairs policy for the American Jewish Committee, the largest Jewish organization and most powerful in the United States of America. And he said, my God, let's not have campaign reform. Then our power will be weakened. So true, ladies and gentlemen. So true. Well, they can not only keep you from getting the money you need, but let me tell you something. If you say something they don't like, if you took a position of, say, Walt and Mearsheimer of the Harvard paper, or you said that American policy in the Middle East is harming this country, that the war in Iraq is hurting America, it's a war for Israel, not for America. And of course it is a war for Israel. From the very beginning it was started by Israeli partisans, Israeli radicals. Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, David Wormser. We can just keep going on and on about these neocons and their power. And the media ran a cheering section for this war. And their power in media is legend. Please read my book, Jewish Supremacism, and you'll get a good idea of what's going on here. Now today, I want to talk about a different issue. You know, with all the talk about the Mearsheimer paper and my work, I'm never endedly called an anti-Semite. and I'm accused of anti-Semitism. But, you know, everybody is. Anybody who criticizes our policy in Israel or around the world is called an anti-Semite. Now, what really does that mean? And what is anti-Semitism? Today I'm going to talk about some of the roots of anti-Semitism, and some of the material I'm going to talk about is sourced, and you can find references to it in my book, Jewish Supremacy, Jewish Supremacism, and you can read about this in this chapter, The Roots of Anti-Semitism 1, Economic Exploitation. And I want to talk to you and try to talk frankly about what anti-Semitism is, how it's defined, and how they use this term to really silence any sort of dissent or any sort of criticism or opposition. When I became aware of the existence of Jewish supremacism and its powerful influence in the United States government and the American media, I spoke openly about it. I can remember well, in a high school civics class, I remarked that Jewish bureaucrats who authored American media's policy had a potential conflict of interest. In an effort to quickly dismiss me, my teacher pointed out that the President of the United States was a Gentile. I recounted to her what I thought was an impressive list of important government officials that were held by Zionist Jews who would likely put Israel's interests over the strategic interests of the United States. My teacher, frustrated in trying to rebut my points, dropped an intellectual atomic bomb. She said, "That's the kind of sentiment that led to the deaths of 6 million Jews. You don't want to give us the impression you're an anti-Semite, do you?" The usually restless and boisterous class became still, and I fell silent. I feared being accused of anti-Semitism at that age. What was anti-Semitism? Had I become an anti-Semite for simply opposing elements of Jewish supremacism, of Jewish extremism? That afternoon, I went to the school library and found some books on anti-Semitism. And interestingly enough, I noticed that Jews wrote all of them. And from what I could discern, most of the writers, not only Jews, but they were radical Jews. They were Zionists. I looked up anti-Semitism in the 4 encyclopedias on the library shelves of my school and found that all the articles on anti-Semitism had Jewish authors. As illustrated by the popular Microsoft Encarta Encyclopedia published by Folk and Wagnalls, they are still authoring almost all the articles on anti-Semitism. The Encarta article on anti-Semitism is a Jewish author, Noam Norbert Glaser, a revered scholar in the Jewish community and author of the very supremacist and ethnocentric book called Jewish History. Encarta also has a recommended reading list on anti-Semitism. And let me give you some of the names that they recommend that you can to find out more about anti-Semitism and what it's all about. Here's the names they gave. Alex Bine, Nathan Belf, François Friette, David Gerber, Jacob Katz, Bernard Lewis, Leon Polakoff, Jehuda Reinhartz. The common theme to the article about so-called anti-Semitism and all the Jewish authored books recommended by the encyclopedia is simple. The theme is that throughout history, Jews have been innocent victims of evil Gentiles. In hundreds of civil, national, and religious reactions against Jews outlined by these books, there is never a hint that Jews could have done anything of a disreputable nature. They were always innocent little lambs led to the slaughter. Christians, Muslims, Zoroastrians, pagans, and other antagonists are all said to be motivated by religious or ethnic intolerance and hatred of all Jews. The books also argue that innocent Jews are universally made into scapegoats for social and economic problems. And just so the reader understands, and the person that goes into these encyclopedias understands, it's not just Encarta. Here's a good example from what I have in front of me, Grohler's Encyclopedia. They have an article on anti-Semitism. It's authored by Eric Rosenthal, and I presume he picked out the reading list so people can learn about anti-Semitism. And here's the reading list. Shmuel Almog, Hannah Arendt, Michael Curtis, Jacob Katz, Leonard Dernstein, J.G. Geiger, D.A. Gerber, Leon Polakoff. Now, aren't these suggested reading lists equivalent to recommending articles on the Arab-Israeli conflict written only by Palestinians? Are articles written only by Israelis? Are articles on communism written only by anti-communists? Are about communism only by communists? It is suggested that some of the authors, have some problems with certain aspects of the Jewish community, but it seems their problems are always about the fact that Jews didn't resist anti-Semitism earlier and didn't organize and be tougher against it, which is kind of interesting. They don't ever seem to argue that Jews are responsible for any problems with Gentiles. It's always the Gentile problems. It's suggested really by the authors that inherent Jewish superiority in ability and morals causes Gentiles to be jealous and spiteful. Many books on anti-Semitism even argue that anti-Semitism is a manifestation of mental illness and that it's even an inherent defect among Gentiles. In discussing the almost universal oft-repeated anti-Jewish attitudes of the last 2,000 years, Glatzer, Rosenthal, and the other Jewish people I've mentioned, they may have been, at least in part, responsible for the repeated negative reactions to them. One would also never suspect that Jews themselves had held any intolerant attitudes toward Christians and other Gentiles, without exception. In every conflict between Jews and Gentiles, the Gentiles or the Christians are depicted as wholly evil, while Jews are depicted as totally blameless paragons of goodness. Now, Glatzner, Rosenthal, and other Jewish partisans have a one-sided point of view. None of the books mention that the negative Christian reaction to Judaism arose out of the Jewish anti-Gentile rhetoric of the Talmud and the persecution of early Christians by Jews, such as Paul, which is talked about in the Bible extensively, Saul, until his conversion. Viciously anti-Gentile Jewish teachings long predated the anti-Jewish Christian writers, but none of these Jewish authors even mentions this important fact. The more I read, the more I realized that the articles and books castigating Europeans as anti-Semites are racist in the most pejorative sense. To portray a race of people as inherently psychotic and murderous is just about the worst thing someone can say about a race. And yet the mainstream Jewish media characterizes European Christians precisely that way. And it must be said that the media also categorizes Palestinians and Arabs in the most unflattering ways as well. So, this is how I'm supposed to get at the truth about anti-Semitism, I thought to myself. Jewish chauvinists must explain it to me. If that's good logic, then we might as well learn about the Second World War only from the perspective of Nazis, or the history of the Palestinian people only from followers of Menachem Begin. How could anyone discover the truth about the causes of the Gentile-Jewish conflict from reading only the Jewish side of it, or only from those Gentiles who endorsed the Jewish view? Gentile writers cannot help but learn quickly that there are great advantages to adopting the Jewish point of view to get their books accepted by major publishers or reviewed in the thoroughly Jewish New York Times book review. The same is true if they want to be interviewed on programs such as the Jewish Produced Today show. And of course, they must promote Philo-Semitism for their works to become recommended reading by the encyclopedias. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll say one more thing. If indeed they say anything negative about Jews, not only will they not get that coverage, but if their book does get out and somebody does publish it, they will endure the worst kind of hateful criticism and attacks. Now, why in all the mainstream media are people not allowed to hear the reasonable view that anti-Semitism has frequently been a reaction to Jewish supremacism and misanthropy? Certainly there have been intolerant outbreaks of anti-Semitism in which innocent Jews have suffered or died. Now, that being said, we must also acknowledge that Jews have committed more than their share of anti-Gentile intolerance, and dare I say it, genocide. However, we never hear about the Jewish excesses. To end the recurring cycles of anti-Semitism, we must try to learn its real causes. Is anti-Semitism an irrational response that finds its genesis in the mental pathology of its adherents? Or does it find its origin as an understandable reaction to Jewish behaviors? It is reasonable, I think, that Jewish supremacy and anti-Semitism nourished each other over the generations, ultimately producing the modern horrors of the Second World War, the so-called Holocaust, and Zionist imperialism. The conflict may well reach a dehumanizing crescendo in the 21st century, unless we learn the true roots of the conflict between Jew and Gentile. To understand what's motivated Gentile opposition to Jews as a group, it is important to be aware of Jewish patterns of behavior that Glatzner and other authorities in anti-Semitism fail to acknowledge. So-called anti-Semites have alleged over the centuries that as a group, Jews have disproportionately engaged in ethical and exploitive practices such as usury, the slave trade, prostitution, fraudulent business schemes, and various other criminal enterprises. Many have alleged that Jews use unethical business practices and collusion to gain control over commerce. Anti-Semites have charged that many historical examples exist of Jews collaborating with the foreign enemies of their host nations. Charges of Jewish disloyalty have been voiced since the time of their sojourn in Egypt and have continued to the present day. Examples are the convicted Adams bomb spies, the Rosenbergs, and more recently, Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard. So I decided to dig into the roots of anti-Semitism, and I began to dig into the principle of whether anti-Semitism came from religious intolerance or economic conflict and resentment. When I delved into the great body of popular Jewish authors in anti-Semitism, two themes emerged. The first and most popular theme is that anti-Semitism stems from the fact that Gentiles blame Jews for the crucifixion of Jesus. To quote the Encarta Encyclopedia, Jews from the 4th century and perhaps even before then were viewed as the killers of Jesus Christ. Another theme of Jewish and philo-Jewish writers is that anti-Semitism arose from Gentile jealousy of Jewish economic and social success. Jewish writer Arthur Hertzberg shows how blaming anti-Semitism on Christian intolerance has a strategic advantage. Now, this is Arthur Hertzberg, I will quote from. To blame Christianity and only Christianity for most anti-Semitism has certain advantages for Jews. Their suffering through the centuries can be conceived as noble martyrdom. The attacks on Jews are not to be connected with their own distinctive beliefs, culture, and patterns of behavior. And in some cases, their faults, but only with their faith. Through study of historical Jewish-Gentile interaction, you can find that blaming the crucifixion of Christ on the Jews had only a minor role in ancient and modern anti-Semitism. For instance, biblical passages asserting that Jews crucified Jesus Christ did not prevent Christians from trying to convert Jews and bring them into the Christian community. Obviously, the Christian church did not see Jews as irredeemable because of the actions of their Pharisaic ancestors. Early multi-ethnic Christians opposed Jews not on the basis of race or ethnicity, but primarily because of Jewish beliefs and practices. In regard to religion, Jews as a group were opposed primarily because of their intractable, anti-Christian, and anti-Gentile character of the Talmud. And concomitant anti-Christian acts, illustrated, you might say, by the mass persecution and murder of Christians, such as by Nero's Jewish mistress, Poppaea Sabina. A stark contrast to the ethnically more tolerant Christians, Jews based their opposition to Gentiles on race. So in comparison to the Christian opposition to Jews, which was not on race, and the Christians tried to convert Jews readily, the Jewish opposition to Christians was based on blood, was based on race, was based on heritage, was based on ethnic purity. This is, to me, a very fascinating and we're delving right now into the very heart of the roots of anti-Semitism and the root of the lies that are presented to the American people and the European people, people around the world every day by these same Jewish interpreters, such as Glatzner and others, about what anti-Semitism is and what the nature of this conflict is. Okay. Jews base their opposition to Gentiles on race. While Christians repeatedly tried to convert Jews, Jews made no real attempt to convert Christians. Instead, they erected barriers to conversion. And the small number of Gentiles who did convert were denigrated. And by the way, they were designated as bastards by Jewish law. Jewish priests were forbidden to marry Jews who were converts or even descendants of converts. And that's a policy still in effect today, even in Israel. It's by law. In all of Jewish history and Western civilization, there's not one Gentile convert who became a significant Jewish leader. Of course, you can name a lot of names of Jews who became significant Christian leaders, such as I mentioned earlier, Saul of Tarsus, who became Paul. Christianity evolved from a precarious fledgling faith into the state religion of Rome, and later Europe itself became synonymous with Christendom. Once secure in its power, Christianity became more tolerant of other faiths, even if disapproving of them. Hostility toward Jews found its base in economic, social, ethnic, and political issues, and there is much evidence that these factors dominated anti-Jewish attitudes during times of little religious turmoil. For instance, anti-Semitism was not historically limited to Christians, but found virulent expression before the Christian era and in many non-Christian lands. The Bible itself records a lot of these activities, such as Haman, such Amalek, such as the Pharaoh. And you can go further. Even the Greeks wrote many disparaging lines about the conduct and the behavior of the Jewish minority that happened to be in their lands. Religious antagonism often seemed to be a rationalization of economic and social hostility. Now, I looked, as a young man, I sought out the works of the giants of European literature, philosophy, and science on the Jewish issue. Sometimes I would spend hours in the library looking up Jews and Judaism in the indexes of the books of some of the greatest Western writers. I found that many had things to say that would be considered anti-Semitic today. It would be impossible to list them all, but a few of them include Milton, most of the Catholic popes, as well as major Protestant leaders. A good example is not only the popes issue edicts against the Talmud and Jewish hatred of Gentiles, but also people such as Martin Luther did so. Shakespeare, Kant, Goethe, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Voltaire, Shaw, Emerson, Melville, Dickens, even my favorite American author, Mark Twain, made some interesting comments about the Jews. Some of Twain's comments on the Jews appear in an 1899 Harper's Magazine article, and many of his comments are very flattering to the Jewish people. But some parts of his essay are absolutely impermissible today. And I'll quote from that article. In the Cotton States, after the war, the simple and ignorant Negroes made the crops for the white planter on shares. The Jew came down in force, set up shop at the plantation, supplied all the Negroes' wants on credit, and at the end of the season was proprietor of the Negroes' share of the present crop and part of his share of the next one. Before long, the whites detested the Jew, and it's doubtful if the Negro loved him. Another excerpt. The Jew was being legislated out of Russia. The reason is not concealed. He was always ready to lend money on a crop and to sell vodka and other necessities of life on credit while the crop was growing. When settlement day came, he owned the crop, and the next year or year after, he owned the farm, much like Joseph. And in the dull and ignorant England of John's time, everybody got into debt to the Jew. He gathered all the lucrative enterprises into his hands. He was the king of commerce. He was ready to be helpful in all profitable ways. He says, religious prejudices may account for one part of it, and anti-Semitic prejudice, but not for the other nine. That's from Mark Twain. To my amazement, Jewish histories, which are intended mainly for Jewish eyes, frankly record cases of Jewish economic exploitation of Gentiles from ancient times to the present. I mean, literally thousands of cases in their chronicles and their books. I found the Jewish historians far more enlightening on the issue than the Gentile writers, and I found that the Jewish writers for Gentile consumption under the topic of anti-Semitism for some reason left out a lot of what the Jewish writers had said about their own people in terms of criminal actions, economic crimes against the people among whom they lived. Now, these Jews, obviously, these Jewish writers, historians, had no prejudice against Jews. If anything, they had a clearly supremacist bias for their own people. And many of them practically gloated about the financial victories of Jews over the Goyim. Immanuel Kant talked about usury. That's the first major issue, and it's been associated with Jews since very, very early. Jews are a nation of usurers, outwitting the people amongst whom they find shelter. They make the slogan, "Let the buyer beware," their highest principle in dealing with us. That's from Immanuel Kant. The philosopher Immanuel Kant was not the first Westerner to make the charge that Jews are a nation of usurers and that their economic practices were often exploitive. Since the Israelites' sojourn in Egypt, non-Jewish politicians, theologians, and chroniclers have spoken of Jewish avarice and exploitive practices. Even Shakespeare immortalized the Jewish usurer in The Merchant of Venice through his character Shylock, who, in the absence of the money due him, demands the Christian's pound of flesh. There are numerous examples of medieval governments receiving huge percentages of their revenues from the taxation received and the profits of Jewish usury. In the diaspora, the Jewish people living outside of Palestine, there is a pattern of Jews being employed by Gentile kings and governments as tax farmers and revenue collectors, and of their being utilized as the administrators of foreign occupational governments. Now, by their very nature, farming and ranching require periodic infusions of capital. Diseases, insect infestation, natural disasters can place those who cultivate crops or animals at the mercy of those who have ready money to lend. This is especially true among those who draw little more than their essential sustenance from such pursuits, which is true for most people from ancient times to the modern era. Historically, such needs for capital were often provided by the cooperatives and by intervention of the civil authorities, but more often such needs went unanswered, resulting in times of severe suffering and want. In all business, capital is crucial to ameliorating the unforgiving cycles of prosperity and recession, of feast and famine, of good weather and bad weather. Amid these economic uncertainties enters the Jewish moneylender. Far more skilled and knowledgeable in the manipulation of currency and gold than his customers, he walks like a fox among the sheep. Now, there was little financial regulation of lending practices until fairly recent times, offering many opportunities for the unscrupulous. And it should be made clear that the term usury means not simply a fair and moderate interest rate, but an excessive one. Usury would be what one would call loan sharking today, with exorbitant interest and compound interest rates. Usury, the lending or practice of lending money at an exorbitant amount of rate of interest, especially in excess of the legal rate. Interest paid for the use of money. That's the definitions of usury. And loan sharking, here's a definition from Random House. Loan sharking is the practice of lending money at excessive rates of interest. You see, they're synonymous. Now, Jews themselves understood the exploitive nature of their usurious practice on the Gentiles. Maimonides, who's considered the greatest European Jewish teacher, wrote the following in his important Book of Civil Laws. And this is one of the major philosophers and teachers of the Jewish people. Quote, "It is permissible to borrow from a heathen or from an alien resident and to lend to him at interest. For it's written, thou shalt not lend upon interest to thy brother," Deuteronomy 23:20. "To thy brother it is forbidden, but to the rest of the world is permissible. Indeed, it is an affirmative commandment to lend money at interest to a heathen. For it's written, unto the heathen thou shalt lend upon interest." That's from the Code of Maimonides, Book 13, the Book of Civil Laws. Now listen to this. Nesek means biting, usury, and Marbit increase interest are one and the same thing. Why is it called Nessic? This is from the Code of Maimonides. Because he who takes it bites his fellow, causes pain to him, and eats his flesh. So here's Maimonides, one of the greatest teachers, supposed to be a real liberal teacher, by the way, of the Jewish people, and one of the most respected Jews of all time, is admitting that it's fine to practice usury on Gentiles, and that by doing so, he's biting his fellow. He's causing him pain. He's eating his flesh. Now, the usury practiced by Jews in the medieval world is outrageous by modern standards. History of the Jews in England. Cecil Roth, another Jewish gentleman, found Jews charging interest rates between 22 and 43%. In northern France, the interest rate was limited to 43% in 1206. That's the max. And the authorities tried to reduce the prevailing rate of 65% plus compounding. The Jews of Poland, the social and economic history of the Jewish community in Poland from 1100 to 1800, writer Bernard Weinrib shows similar outlandish rates in Poland at the 14th and 15th centuries. And in the 1942 book, The Jews in Spain, Their Political and Cultural Life During the Middle Ages, the Jewish author A.A. Newman writes that in Castile, the authorities allowed Jews to charge an interest rate of 33.13% when farmers desperately needed to purchase seed during the Great Famine in 1326. The Jews refused to lend money unless they were allowed 40%. So we can go on and on about this issue. I'll take it up with you maybe tomorrow, because if you'd like, I'll be happy to do this program and we'll talk in depth about some of these basic issues. So tomorrow I will continue on with some news about the day, and I'll also go into the definition and some more information on usury, about Jewish commercial activities and how this caused a great deal of disrespect and anger and opposition to Jews in general. I'll talk about the Jewish team strategy in economics and how, by working together as a group, how that gives them certain advantages in gaining wealth and gaining power in Gentile corporations or in Gentile societies. I'll talk about the manipulation of stock exchanges and banks. We can, in fact, go into some of the how the Rothschild family developed their fortune, a very famous struggle at Waterloo, and how Rothschild put out bad information to the English stock market and literally bought up today's values of billions of dollars on the English market for pennies, and it's a very interesting story, and I'll talk about that again tomorrow, and then maybe later I'll talk to you about some of the involvement in crime and treachery. Now, I'm not saying by all these things that every Jew is involved in these kind of activities, and as I said yesterday, I quoted some very interesting Jewish leaders and Jewish activists and thinkers and writers who wrote very poignantly about the, about some of the evil that these Jewish supremacists do, that some of these Jewish extremists do in Israel and elsewhere around the world, and how that they think these supremacists are doing wrong, and they must be opposed. So there are individual Jews out there. My book, Jewish Supremacism, in fact, is dedicated to a Jew, Israel Shahak, who very bravely and courageously stood up to Jewish supremacism and warned that this is not only a tremendous danger for Gentiles, but it's also a danger for Jews. That this ends up in having the kind of reactions to Jews. The idea that Gentiles are always evil, and that's the basic theme of the anti-Semitic books, I'm talking about the books on anti-Semitism that are popular. The books on anti-Semitism, the popular books that you can get into in your bookstores, that you can find in any library in the United States or in England or France or Germany or Austria or wherever. The popular books on anti-Semitism you can find all over the world. Now, the common theme is that the Jewish people as a group have always been innocent, and in their conflict with Gentiles were always right and decent, while the Gentiles were irreconcilably evil, and at fault in almost any, well, not in almost, in every case the Gentiles were at fault. To me, that strains some credibility. And we're talking about here some things from Jewish history and Jewish writers that explain why there's been so much opposition to Jews throughout history. Why the Jews, for instance, have been expelled from almost every nation of Europe at one time or another, and many other nations around the world, and sometimes repeatedly. Could it have been that they were always innocent, or could it have been that a section of the Jewish people, a very vocal and powerful section, and unfortunately, often they're the leaders of the Jewish community, just like the oligarchs in Russia. One of the oligarch criminals was Mr. Grudzinski, Vladimir Grudzinski, who stole hundreds of billions of dollars, involved himself in all kinds of organized crime activity, and he was also head of the Jewish community in Russia. And we can talk about Berezovsky. We can talk about many of these individuals. The man right now putting pressure on Harvard to get rid of Dr. Stephen Walt. His name is Belker, and he was one of the officials of Enron Corporation. And he made hundreds of millions of dollars by this inside advance information. I don't know why he wasn't indicted, but let me tell you, he's right in the middle of it. So there's connections there, ladies and gentlemen, and they're not tenuous connections. One of the biggest Jewish organizations that fights against people such as myself is the Anti-Defamation League, and they've gotten a huge amount of money over the years, millions of dollars over the years, from Jewish gangsters. I'm not kidding, Jewish gangsters. And we're going to talk about that either tomorrow or the next day. I'm going to go into some of the organized crime, and believe it or not, there's a far greater connection between Jews and organized crime than, say, Italians and organized crime. But for some reason, our media is so biased, they've created a connection in everybody's mind. You know, the minute you hear some Italian music, Italian language, you think of The Godfather, and you think of Italians and organized criminals. And the Italians, I must say, they've taken this with a grain of salt. They haven't issued all these terrible attacks, you know. They haven't tried to run out of business anybody that says these things or talks about Italians this way. But 99% of Italians are not in organized crime. They're decent people. Italy's one of the most wonderful countries in the world, in my opinion. I love being over there. And the Italian people, many of them were some of my best supporters in my campaigns, and so many that I can just name right offhand, who have been my friends for years and years and years. And none of the ones that I know are in any way involved in organized crime. But this has been put on the people by the same Jewish media that if you kind of characterize a Jew in any way negatively, you are called an anti-Semite, but nobody calls them anti-Italian. And isn't it interesting? Here are these Jews who have so much connection with organized crime, and I'll go into those details tomorrow or the next day. And the connection is incredible. The biggest organized crime group in the world today is what they call the Red Mafia, or the Orchestraya. And they're not Russian mobsters. They're Jewish mobsters from Russia. And they have organized the biggest white slave trade in the world. They have the most dangerous, ruthless, murderous criminal activity in the world. And they are literally completely led by Jews, extremist Jews. And yet, in the media, we make very little connection. In fact, the media, the same liberal Jewish media that equates Italians with organized crime, often calls this organized crime fashion the Russian mob, or the Russian gangsters or something. They're not Russian at all. And that's a double lie. Not only is it really besmirching the Russians who are not involved in organized crime to a great degree. In fact, in Russia, today in Russia, and I go there quite often, and I can tell you, the organized crime is almost all non-Russian. The organized criminals from Chechnya control a lot of the markets, you know. Many organized Jews control most of the organized crime markets and organized crime activities. They've robbed Russia of 11 oligarchs who own over 60% of the resources of the Russian nation. And they own this not from hard work. They got this literally in a year from bribery, corruption, and theft from the Russian people. And of those 11, 10 of them are Jews. 10 of them are Jews. And they did it through coalescing working together and involving in every sort of criminal activity imaginable. Bribery, corruption, extortion, murder, you name it. So ladies and gentlemen, there's a tremendous double standard. I don't consider myself an anti-Semite. But I tell you one thing, we need to begin to learn of what these terms really mean, why there's been an opposition to some of the organized Jewish presence in nations in the past, and if Jewish people are sincerely want to live among us without having the resentment against them that so many people have, then they certainly are going to have to clean their own house before they can start talking about Europeans cleaning our house and about how terrible we've behaved and acted. They're going to definitely have to clean their own. And we can talk about more of these issues, but that's about it for now. We've run out of time today. God bless all of you, and I want you to take care. This is a heck of a show. I believe that everyone will get a great benefit from listening to this program. So you can tell your friends and your family about this show. Send them an email. Give them the link to davidduke.com. And let's get this program out and let it be heard by people all over the world.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.davidduke.com.